A very good day, afternoon or morning, wherever you are. My name is Dirk Pilat. I'm the medical director for e-learning at the RCGP. Today, I'm interviewing Dr. Jonathan Leach, the honorary secretary at the RCGP. Jonathan, would you be so kind to introduce yourself, tell us where you work, and more importantly, what does an honorary secretary do?
Yeah, thank you very much, Dirk. So I'm Jonathan Leach. I'm a general practitioner. I'm salaried at Davenport House Surgery in Bromsgrove. This is a moderate size, 9,000 average size practice. I work there clinically, and this is a surgery where I've been 11 years. We look after 6 nursing care homes, predominantly stable but quite elderly population. And so there are lots of challenges regarding that. So I work there clinically. And then also I work for the Royal College of GPs as the Joint Honorary Secretary, which is as one of the senior officers. And certainly over the last, for example, a few months, I've been the clinical lead actually for the Royal College GPs. So it's been a very busy time in terms of actually trying to make sure that the college is supporting members and the wider GP and primary care community, as well as actually where appropriate and where possible, making sure that policy either within England or the devolved nations as appropriate is sensible and takes in the needs of GPs. Internally, the honorary secretary is particularly involved around governance and making sure that the college does things properly. It's probably a good way of putting it.
Well, with that sort of workload, you're probably coming home knackered in the evening. Now, during the pandemic, all of us are working at unprecedented levels at present. And Jennifer Napier once wrote that for GPs, each day is adrenaline-soaked survival. Many of us now are taking a work home to look at results, finish reports, review cases, and we're getting more and more tired. So what would you suggest how we reduce our workload so we have time to recuperate in the evenings and the weekend?
So these are things which we do in our surgery. I think it will be down to lots of other people, but we have a culture whereby, you know, we keep an eye on each other. And for example, a very practical thing, when we do duty doctor, it can sometimes be very busy and very difficult to manage the volumes of patients who are either wanting to be seen or assessed remotely and potentially with 6 care homes, nursing care homes, obviously home visits and things like this. So we have a culture, firstly, of sort of keeping an eye on each other's workload. And I have generally a view of, you know, what comes around goes around. So I keep an eye on, you know, how, if I've got space, you know, maybe at the end, or so how's the duty doctor doing? So, you know, if I've come to the end and I'll look to see, and if the duty doctor is overwhelmed, then what I will do is dive in. And even if it's just a few of those patients, with obviously consent and making sure it isn't specific to the individual doctor, which it sometimes can be, is actually seeing whether or not we can help each other. And I think that some of this sort of workload sharing, I think, is really important. Also, it's important to have, if possible, a sort of collegiate atmosphere. I'm a great believer in the simple things of the coffee morning, although these days it's by Zoom or Teams. In our surgery, again, the clinical meetings we have regularly, and it's done by Zoom or Teams because we need to be socially distancing. But actually, there are some really, really simple things to make sure that, if you like, we are all okay today. And I think that's very important. In terms of other things, is I'm a great believer in doing as much as we can use of maybe other people. Our surgery now has 2 brilliant and excellent pharmacists. They've been probably one of the biggest booms in terms of taking some of the workload off us, so a delegation type of approach, which I think is helpful. We've also employed a senior nurse who's particularly skilled in the care of more senior members of our patient group. So again, sort of working with that person and a sort of delegation. So I think there are things about, is it something which I as the GP need to do, or is it something which other people can do? And then also, for example, we use our administrative staff to code things within, we use EMIS, but the principles would apply. So are there other people that can do things? I think they're also then potentially just being mindful that technology can sometimes be a double-edged sword. So can we use technology to actually help us? So the use of macros, as we were doing with, so it fills in text, if you like, within EMIS or other computers, and then more generally, so we can actually speed things up, you know. And I think there are some of these sort of very practical things actually which we can do. It's trying also then to sort of separate out the stresses and strains of life, if you like, from my clinical work. I don't have my phone on, I don't have my other computers on, so I focus on that and then deal with other things as they come along. So I think there are some practical things we can do, but clearly it's a very busy time. Winter always is, and you know, obviously there are real concerns about how winter this year will go, and especially in the context of what seems to be obviously an increasing pandemic.
You and I have just recorded a screencast on trauma and burnout for primary care or in primary care physicians. And there are loads of very moving, very personal stories from GPs experiencing stress, fear, and anxiety. The doctor who set up the physician burnout website wrote, "I worried about patients coming to harm through a hypothetical drug interaction that flashed up with ever-increasing frequency on prescribing alert system. I would wake up regularly in a cold sweat, fearful that I'd missed something or not considered some rare diagnosis or possibility. I felt that everything that happened or had happened was somehow my responsibility, my fault. I became increasingly overwhelmed. I wasn't sleeping. I lost weight. I started withdrawing from my friends and family." Now that our workload is increasing, I'm sure that a lot of us feel like this. Do you know of intervention that can help us avoid going down this particular rabbit hole?
So, Dirk, as you know, I was in the military for many years. So I've been in very stressful situations in terms of being on some of the operational tours I've done. And then clearly coming back into the NHS. And actually, it's normal sometimes for us to have these sorts of reactions, you know, when we're under a lot of stress. And actually, as a general rule, I find that healthcare professionals, because we tend to be very professional, because we want to do the right thing, if things go wrong, or we're worried about things going wrong, often it's the very, very professional people who actually have the worst sort of views about this. So it's quite common. And if there's specific incidents that somebody is worried about, and I can bring to mind, I don't have PTSD, but I can bring to mind certain incidents that I've been involved with, which don't cause me distress, but I can bring to mind, you know, particular patients or incidents. And but that is normal. That's a normal part of being human. And actually, it keeps me balanced in that I know about them. On the other side, though, if they start affecting people, if they start causing, such as the symptoms which you've read out, waking up in the night, cold sweats, things like this, that's not normal. And actually, I think there are some simple things that we could do. Firstly, to actually recognize them, and that's the most important thing. Some of the incidents I've known, been involved with, they caused me some intrusive thoughts and nightmares for a few days, but then settled. That's normal. That is normal. The fact that it's settled and I don't get those now is fine. But if they continue, then clearly that's not right by virtue of the fact that it's causing distress and also potentially intruding into people's life and their well-being. So the main things about these symptoms is recognizing that either you may be having this, or if somebody discloses that to you, that actually there is firstly help out there. Recognizing it yourself is probably, or in other people, is probably the first important step. And then seeking assistance regarding this. And as I said, for particular incidents, if it settles after a few days, that can be normal. The formal diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder, although this also would include stress, post-traumatic distress disorder, the formal diagnosis is after a month. But clearly, if there's something which is worrying people, then it should be almost like get it off your chest early. It's quite a sort of trite thing I do sometimes discuss with my patients. But actually, having that personal reflectiveness that actually we are human ourselves, we have our own emotions, and therefore it can be appropriate for us to have that thought that we need to deal with it, either by disclosing. Also, people take exercise or do other hobbies, which actually, if you like, take them away from the space so that actually they've got ways in which they can cope.
Many of us crave a glass of wine after a particularly stressful day, which can, of course, open a rather dangerous can of worms. What kind of alternatives would you suggest to increase our endorphin levels apart from a glass of wine or two?
So many people use exercise. Doesn't really matter what. I run, and for example, I managed even with sore knees to run 13 kilometers with my GP registrar daughter yesterday. So exercise, it could be Pilates, it could be yoga, it could be going for a bike ride. It doesn't really matter. Many people do use exercise, but clearly sometimes it can be quite difficult in GP surgery because it tends to be quite a sedentary job when we're in. Other things would be other hobbies. And again, probably it doesn't really matter what that is. I play the piano very badly. So to use the Morecambe and Wise, the right notes in the wrong order, but that gives me pleasure, but actually it gives me a way of being able to manage the stress and strains. I think there are other ways which people can do this. Many people I know read, they might have other hobbies, but I think the main thing is actually having activities outside of medicine would be the main thing. And in terms of alcohol, as we all know, as doctors, a small amount is fine. But clearly, if we start drinking to excess, and clearly if we start using other substances, then it can have a significant impact upon our ability to act, to work as clinicians, and also as people. So that you know, the obvious advice there would be, don't go down that route. But a small amount is acceptable. But many of us would use these other routes in order to keep us down the straight and narrow and being able to keep going.
Once you suspect one of your colleagues might be struggling, how would you approach him or her and offer to help?
I think the first thing is that it's better to do it. I've done quite a lot of supporting doctors over the years, and I think the most important thing is do something, but it needs to be sensitive. You know, it needs to be the right person, it needs to be done in a sensitive way, and it needs to be done in a way which isn't threatening. So that a sensitive word by a colleague or friend who they trust about how are you, you know, or even framing it round the other way. You know, actually, I found today really difficult. You know, I had so many patients. How are you today? And sometimes framing things that way round can be quite helpful in terms of opening things up with an individual. I think then there's also about, that's a sort of low level. If things become more serious, there are avenues where more professional help can be sought. People can see their own GP, and I've seen many GPs and other healthcare workers, myself as their doctor, over many years, probably over 1,000, several thousand actually, and actually getting them to see their own GP, I think, is important. And then there are other avenues such as the BMA, practitioner health programme. But I think probably the most important thing is doing nothing often just stores up problems. And whilst there may be concerns that you wouldn't want that person to go off at that time, and we understand that, or I understand that, in the long term, if you don't intervene, the general view is actually things are worse. And actually, if that person goes off, they're often off for longer. So sensitively trying to find a form of words to approach somebody and trying to do something about it would be what most of us would recommend.
Jonathan, thank you so much for your time. I hope that our listeners out there found this helpful. Dear colleagues out there and whoever's listening, I hope that your winter is not going to be too bad, that your resilience levels are at 110, and that you are well and stay well.